Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Hi, everyone, and thanks for joining us today for another Ogletree Deacons Podcast. My name is Jansen Ellis, and I am Senior Marketing Counsel at Ogletree Deacons. Today, we're here to talk about the top five labor and employment concerns for multinational businesses. And joining me today to talk about this topic is Diana Nero. Diana is a shareholder in Ogletree's International Practice Group, and I'm excited to have her here to talk about this important issue. How are you today, Diana?
I'm great, Jansen. How are you?
Doing well. So let's jump right into the topic. There are tons of labor and employment issues that multinational companies need to keep in mind. Today, we've got time just to cover five of the most important concerns. So let's talk about number one, the absence of at-will employment outside the U.S. Let's talk quickly, Diana, about the basics. What is at-will employment?
So at-will employment is the right of an employer to terminate an employee's employment for any reason or no reason at all, provided that it's not on the basis of a protected class or a discriminatory reason.
And is at-will employment unique to the U.S.?
Definitely. Outside of the United States, there is no concept of at-will employment, and you need to have cause to terminate employment. And cause generally, it varies from country to country and is based in the country's local labor code, but it generally includes conduct that we in the U.S. think of as gross misconduct.
What types of things do employers with employees outside of the U.S. need to keep in mind when terminating employees outside the U.S.?
Well, so as I just alluded to, you need to have cause to terminate, and that's something that we're definitely not used to in the United States. So prior to terminating an employee in another jurisdiction, you need to make sure that they've engaged in conduct that you can prove and substantiate that rises to the level of cause as it's defined in that particular jurisdiction. And if you don't have it, you have to be prepared to pay severance and in some cases notice as well.
So you talked about cause. A related issue is performance management in those situations. How can a global employer manage poor performers outside the U.S. Where there is no at-will employment?
Sure. It's a really frustrating area for U.S. employers who are starting their first foray into a foreign jurisdiction because it is very, very difficult in nearly every jurisdiction. Poor performance alone, especially a first or second incidence of poor performance, is not going to amount to cause to terminate. And for employers, you know, especially US-based employers, it's really frustrating, right? Because why should you have to pay severance to someone who's not performing well? You know, the reason for that is because there's protections under the local labor codes. So if you want to make performance the basis of a for-cause termination, you have to go through much more of an arduous and extensive process than we're used to dealing with in the States. From a performance improvement plan perspective, you have to be able generally to show that you gave the employee multiple chances, and not just chances, tools and education necessary to improve their performance. So it is a much higher hurdle and much more active involvement is required on the part of the employer. And even then, in many countries, you still may not get to the level of cause.
Right. So it seems like this is going to be country by country in terms of the definitions of cause and what's going to rise to the level of being able to terminate an employee.
That's right.
So let's turn now to our second concern, investigating violations of U.S. laws abroad. Mm-hmm. So when a U.S. employer receives a complaint from a foreign employee, what should the employer do?
You know, I think when an employer receives an employee from outside the U.S. With respect to a violation of U.S. law, the employer has to take it very seriously and conduct an impartial and comprehensive investigation. You know, the hook and the wrinkle here is that because the conduct, I'm assuming in this example, is arising from conduct that's taking place outside the U.S., although it might violate a U.S. law, you have to also take into account and balance the potential laws that apply in terms of how the investigation will proceed in that local jurisdiction because local law will apply there.
So what kinds of U.S. laws apply overseas?
The big one that I always think of is the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. That has obviously extraterritorial application. In addition, some federal anti-discrimination laws can apply as well.
So when an employer is conducting a cross-border investigation, what are some best practices to follow?
I think the best thing you can do is conduct your investigation in accordance with your policies and procedures, but also really make an effort to balance the laws of the local jurisdiction against the regulators that you're going to seek to satisfy by conducting a thorough investigation. You know, the most common area where we see it is in the FCPA context. In certain countries, you can't require employees to participate in investigations as a term and condition of employment the way we do in the U.S. And there's also applicable privacy laws and other statutes that come into play locally. So you want to make sure you're balancing those against conducting an appropriate investigation under U.S. law. You know, at the end of the day, it really is a cost-benefit analysis and a risk analysis. And ultimately, at least from where I'm sitting, you know, you certainly want to make sure you're complying with your obligations with respect to the SEC and the DOJ. And sometimes that does mean running afoul of local employee right legislation. So there could be some cost there.
So that's a lot of things to think about. On a related note, let's talk about our third major concern, which is globalizing discrimination and harassment, training and policies. And this is obviously a very important topic, both in the U.S. and abroad. So given that different countries can have different definitions for discrimination and harassment, what are some best practices for an employer to go about harmonizing those policies?
This is a really important issue, and even more so now in the wake of the Me Too movement. It's absolutely critical that employers globalize their discrimination and harassment policies and trainings and procedures. You're right. In some countries, a definition of discrimination may not neatly tie to how we define it under U.S. law. So it's really important that to the extent that there are local nuances and differences, that you address those too. So for example, when I do a global anti-harassment policy, I know, for example, that India has particular legislation that requires very specific procedures to be undertaken with respect to discrimination and harassment claims. So I would go ahead and draft a global anti-discrimination policy and then include a specific addendum for India. That can be incorporated in trainings as well. You want to make sure that you're training folks on all aspects of discrimination. And that becomes particularly relevant where, for example, you have U.S. managers who have direct reports in India or vice versa. I also think it's really helpful, in addition to specifically addressing nuances in local law, you know, with addendums or particular trainings, to also use sort of to be sure that you address cultural distinctions as well, right? Because from a cultural perspective, what may be offensive to someone in the United States may simply be just part of the culture in another jurisdiction. So you want to make sure that you're not overly imposing sort of a U.S. norm on local trainings as well. You want to be sensitive to the cultural reality with your local workplace.
Great point. So moving on to our fourth concern for multinational companies, this is a big one, global mobility. What are the main types of assignments that we're talking about here?
Well, it's a really interesting question. If you had asked me 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I probably would have said I only do outbound work, which is when you have a U.S. person being sent abroad to work in a foreign jurisdiction for a foreign subsidiary or affiliate, or if you're a foreign headquartered company for the headquarters for a specific period of time. I am more and more recently seeing inbound assignments where employees who are non-U.S. nationals are coming to work at a U.S. headquarters or subsidiary and being seconded from the foreign entity. So that I would refer to as an outbound assignment. So I am seeing an increase in those types of assignments as well. But I think the traditional model of U.S. folks being sent abroad, you know, is the most prevalent still.
Okay. So now that we know about the types of assignments, can you tell us about the key legal areas that are implicated when there's a mobility assignment?
Sure. I mean, I think the most obvious one is immigration law, right? Because that's, if you can't get the work permit or whatever necessary paperwork is required to allow the person to be authorized to work in the foreign jurisdiction, the assignment's not going to happen. So everybody should be, and usually does, think of immigration issues first, but it also implicates a whole host of other issues. Employment laws being, you know, the most obvious one as well. even though the individual typically continues to be an at-will employee of the U.S. company, to the extent that they're being seconded to a foreign entity, that potentially triggers a separate an employment relationship with that individual under the laws of the host country. So you have to make sure that you're balancing U.S. versus local employment law. And then it also trips up payroll tax issues. Typically, unless there's a tax treaty in place between the home country, which I'm assuming in this example is the U.S. and the host country, there's going to be payroll taxes right off the bat that will be applicable to that particular expat, even though they're still a U.S. citizen. In addition, the U.S. is the only country that continues to tax on the basis of worldwide citizenship. So there's going to be taxes on both sides. And so the employer has to make sure that they're putting in the appropriate stopgaps to make sure that they're covering payroll on both sides and putting the employee in the same position as they would have been had they never left the U.S. in the first place. So it can be costly, and it's definitely something that needs to be considered and thought through well before the employee actually goes on assignment. And relatedly with tax, you can potentially, if you don't structure the assignment appropriately, trigger corporate tax issues. And given, you know, that we typically deal with things on the labor and employment and HR side, that's not something that we're always thinking about right away. But I always counsel clients, you want to make sure that however you structure the assignment, that you're vetting it with your local accounting folks and your international tax advisors to the extent that you have them. And in that vein, you also have documentation issues that you need to think about. How are you going to draft the international assignment letter to the employee? And what are you going to do about documenting the intercompany relationship between the host company and the home company? So those are all things that need to be covered.
So let's say that an employer wants to keep an expatriate employee on their U.S. payroll. Based on what you just talked about, it sounds like there might be some potential problems with this.
Yeah, there could be problems. I mean, look, generally speaking, there's fixes. The goal of compensating an employee with respect to an assignment like this is to put them in the same position as they would have been had they never left the U.S. You have to be cognizant of the fact that you're asking someone to pick up their lives and basically upheave it and move it to a foreign jurisdiction to accomplish a business objective on behalf of the global organization. You know, so with that sort of context in the background, there's a lot of benefits that go into expatriate assignments. And one of those benefits is something called tax equalization. And so a typical expat doesn't want to go on a local host country's payroll, right? They want to continue to contribute to U.S. Social Security. They want to continue to contribute to 401k and other compensation-based benefits. So typically, it's very common to keep a U.S. expatriate on the U.S. payroll. But as I said before, barring some treaty or specific agreement between the U.S. and the country at issue, the individual is going to, the remuneration that they're paid for work on foreign soil is going to be subject to taxation under the laws of that country. So what we typically advise clients to do is to keep the person on the U.S. payroll and work with your outside accountants to run what's called a shadow payroll in the foreign jurisdiction, which sounds incredibly nefarious, but is not. It is actually a way of capturing the amount of compensation the person's being made and calculating essentially a hypothetical tax that would apply in the host country and reporting, remitting, and withholding those taxes to the local tax authorities on behalf of the U.S. home company. And so there are some cases where the individual is paying taxes in both countries and can have a double tax burden. The goal of tax equalization is to put, you know, from a tax perspective, to put the employee in the same position that they would be had they never left the, you know, the state that they live in the United States. That will definitely involve getting your tax folks involved. You'll want to stay involved as part of the tax equalization benefit and help the employee prepare their tax returns. What can also happen, which companies don't always think of right away, is that they can inadvertently enjoy a windfall from a tax perspective, the employee can. And you want to make sure that to the extent that that happens, the company is able to recover that money from the employee. So this is all really important stuff to put into the international assignment letters. So you have an agreement with the employee that they'll you know, comply with all of these requirements from a tax equalization perspective. And to the extent that you have multiple employees going abroad, you probably want to put in place a full-blown tax equalization policy as well as an international assignment policy.
All right, lots of good information. So we've gone through several interesting and complicated issues for multinational employers. Let's talk about one final issue, and that is global sales incentive plans. So when companies roll out their U.S. sales plans to foreign employees, expensive consequences can result. So how can an employer have a sales incentive plan that is consistent across multiple jurisdictions?
Really, really good drafting. I mean, drafting is critical. Defining critical terms is so important. And then the most important one I can think of off the top of my head is defining when incentive pay is earned, because everything sort of flows from that. What's tricky with foreign jurisdictions is in some countries, there are very specific laws that relate to commissions, that relate to incentive pay. So you want to be really clear on what kind of incentive plan this is. Are we talking sort of variable incentive pay, or are we actually talking commissions? So you want to make sure that all of that is nailed down and drafted very clearly. You know, there's two approaches you can take. Some global employers don't want to have a perfectly specific policy for every single jurisdiction. So they take sort of more what I call the 80-20 approach and make it work as much as possible from a drafting perspective in the foreign jurisdictions, but know that they're taking a risk, you know, that it may not be entirely enforceable by the employer. I think the larger an organization gets and the more full-blown subsidiaries that they have, the better the better practice is to have a specifically compliant policy jurisdiction by jurisdiction. But I've seen a lot of startup clients that don't actually have entities in every country where they have individuals. And in that case, you know, a more of a global policy can work. But again, it really comes down to very clear drafting. These are complicated plans. They're very accounting based. So you want to make sure that you're drafting and getting the buy-in of your accounting and finance folks as well to make it really, really clear to the employees when compensation is earned and how it'll play out under that local jurisdiction. And another thing to think about that we don't think about in the US is that, you know, targets change every year, right? It's not a static concept. But in many jurisdictions, if an individual's targets are reduced or materially altered in a way such that they're earning less than they have been historically year over year, that can actually create an acquired right issue, which basically means that once you've given a historic sort of consistent payment year over year, if you try to take it away, the employee can say, no, I actually have a contractual right to this or an acquired right to this. You have to leave my targets the way they are. Again, acquired rights is not necessarily such a foreign concept for employers doing business abroad. But when you layer it on to the concept of targets, it can actually be something that folks don't think of right away. So you have to be careful to make sure that even the way the plan and the targets are structured isn't going to ultimately, you know, take a benefit away that the employee has had in prior years.
Well, thank you, Diana. We have gotten to the end of our top five list. To summarize, we talked about the absence of at-will employment outside the U.S. We talked about cross-border investigations, globalizing discrimination and harassment policies, global mobility, and global sales incentive plans. We cover a lot of good stuff today. Thank you, Diana, so much for your time. And thanks, everyone, for listening. And please stay tuned for our next Ogletree Deacons podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.